that joyful music,
it's great.
Having played, I'm so excited to welcome everyone back to another episode of The Classical Scene. I'm Victor Hulls, and for this episode number 13, I have a special friend of mine here with us today, Brendan Sill, who's acting principal bassoon of the Florida Orchestra. Hi, Brendan.
Hey, Victor. So good to be here. And what a great intro.
Hey, yeah,
great.
I thought that Beethoven would be excellent. By the way, we just listened to some of the Triple Concerto, a very unique and wonderful piece by Beethoven written for three soloists, a violin, this time played by Gil Shaham, cello by Anne Gastinel, and pianist, of course, Nicholas Angelich, with Paavo Järvi conducting. But we started with that because in a few weeks, the Florida Orchestra will be performing that with soloists from our own orchestra. Nancy Chang, assistant concertmaster, and Yoni Dryblot, principal cello, will be joining forces with a wonderful pianist. And you can hear that on February 6th and 7th, along with Bruckner Fourth Symphony. So we have a lot of wonderful stuff coming up this month in January that we wanted to talk about. And I think Brendan is one of the perfect people to do some of that.
Well, yeah. That means a lot. And it's, I mean, I'm just so happy that you're doing this. I mean, to bring awareness to what we're doing and what great shows that we're about to do. I mean, this month, February, March, April, I mean, until the end of the season, it's great.
And right. We're quite busy, actually.
I've always seen that when January for any orchestra is really the busiest season you could do, because you're coming back from break and it's just like week after week after week of like hard hitters. Great hard hitters, but really still hard hitters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's the stuff that gets us the most excited as well. All of these Masterworks concerts, one after the next, it's great. So, I mean, we just performed a thrilling concert with Christian Reif, guest conductor, doing some Shostakovich 15th, his last symphony.
Amazing.
And everything on that concert was wonderful.
What a great piece.
And now we got some Billy Joel and some other fun matinees coming up. But then at the end of January is when we play Masterwork 6, the sixth Masterworks of the season. And that program has quite a lot of bassoon feature pieces.
Yeah, that's where I come in, I guess. I've been eyeing this concert for a long, long time. It's just bassoon heaven. So all the pieces have four bassoons on them, except one, which is the Ravel Concerto in G.
Wow, that's pretty luxurious, ladies and gentlemen. With four bassoons.
Four bassoons on each piece, and I don't know what the French really... I don't know what kind of interest in the bassoon they had, but they must have loved it enough to really just beef it up in the section. It must be because of French bassoon back then was just not as it didn't have as much projection as it does now, and so they just thought, okay, we'll just have four bassoons on there.
It was even a tradition since Berlioz, or even earlier.
Yes.
Berlioz often had quintupled enforcement.
Yeah, he on Symphony Fantastique, you have four bassoons on that.
Right.
In his Requiem, he actually writes for eight bassoons.
I know.
Which is crazy.
Insane.
I would love to do that one day.
Basson.
Yeah. Low sound. Literally translates to low sound. It's where we get the term bassoon from.
Oh.
But this concert's going to be great. I mean, just wonderful, wonderful music in French. I mean, how can you go wrong with French music?
Right.
It's
so,
so beautiful.
We're going to play you some more examples of music throughout this episode and from this concert in particular, but it features music by Ravel and Dukas. So that's wonderful. But before we get into that, Brendan, tell us a little more about yourself, because you are a Tampa boy. Right?
We're actually both Florida men, if you can believe it. You're from Jacksonville, and I am from Tampa. Born and raised here in Tampa Bay. Went to USF, proud USF grad, go Bulls. And then I went to Cleveland for grad school. I went to the Cleveland Institute of Music. And it was wonderful. And then I did my fellowship at the New World Symphony down in Miami Beach. So I actually came back to Florida. Victor, that's where you and I met.
Indeed.
And we had so many memorable concerts there. Actually, one of the most memorable concerts I had there was with you conducting.
Aw,
like,
thanks for saying.
Yeah, we did Tritico Botticelliano.
By Respighi.
Yeah, man, that was just so... And then we also did, like, Dumbarton Oaks by Stravinsky with MTT and... Like, just so many great concerts. And then I did that for 2 years. And then I did a one-year contracted gig with the Colorado Symphony.
That's
out
right.
In Denver for the year, and it was incredible, an incredible experience. Great rep, great people out there, incredible mm-hmm. view. I mean, I love the mountains.
Yeah, take me back to the mountains. I love the ocean too, but whenever I'm in Colorado, it feels so special. So that was last season, right?
Correct. Uh-huh. And then Florida Orchestra reached out to me, and they said we're looking for an acting principal bassoon mm-hmm. for the 25-26 season, and they came back around and they picked me to come play for the season, and it's just been a great time so far.
It's
my hometown band on my hometown instrument too, like the instrument I grew up listening to.
There's a very interesting story about your bassoon, right? It's pretty old.
Yeah.
What was its birthday it just celebrated?
It's February 24th, 1934. And the fact that I know that is, I know, super nerdy.
That's perfect.
But yep. I have a whole book of all the registry of instruments that the maker, Heckel, made. It's a Heckel bassoon made in Germany. And it'll turn 92 February 24th, this upcoming February 24th. And
you're going to have a party for it, right?
Oh, of course.
Of course.
And it was actually the previous owner was Anthony Georgeson. He was principal here for like 10, 11-ish years.
Gotcha.
And I grew up listening to him play on this bassoon. So it's like a full circle in many, many, many ways.
Hmm.
Yeah. Played so many great shows on it. And now it's mine, and I get to carry that torch, and it's a really cool feeling knowing that it's back here in TFO.
I love that. Its voice is continuing on a tradition, and you certainly fit right in. You sound amazing. I'm so glad that you're here.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Oh, it's been fun being back. I mean, just seeing old friends, making new, and
And this is not your first season playing with the Florida Orchestra, right? Or at least you had subbed in occasionally in the past.
Yeah, a lot of times I used to play in TFO. Like, actually, one of the first pieces I actually played in was Sorcerer's Apprentice. Like, almost 10 years ago now, which is so crazy to think. But it was while I was at USF, and I played third bassoon on Sorcerer's Apprentice.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is, of course, one of the iconic bassoon motifs, which we are playing on that Masterworks concert on January 23rd, 24th, 25th. Do you want to hear that right now just to jog your memory? I mean, you all know.
I mean, we got to listen to it.
We got to listen to it. Here's a lovely recording from the Frankfurt Radio Symphony. And for anybody who grew up with Fantasia like I did, I'm certainly this conjuring images of a broomstick and water buckets overflowing and just a crazy scene.
How can you not imagine that? I mean, that movie was so just so iconic back then and in today. And whenever people ask me, oh, you're in an orchestra, what do you play? I tell them, oh, I play bassoon. They're like, oh, I don't think I've ever heard the bassoon. I'm like,
yes, you have.
You have. And then I tell them, the broomsticks and Fantasia. They're like, yeah, I love that one. I'm like, that's the bassoon.
There you go.
And they just catch on right then and there. Yeah. It's great.
So tell us a little about what it's like to play that excerpt of music. I mean, it must be kind of satisfying because it's a piece that's so iconic, but also how do you make it your own? And
I mean, that's a great question. It's one of the few excerpts that you just play and it just plays itself, you know?
Mm.
There's so many excerpts out there that you have to spend, or rather, you get to spend so much time making it your own, right? Like Scheherazade, Rite of Spring, Bolero, Tchaikovsky 4. But with Sorcerer's Apprentice, since you have three bassoons playing it all in unison with the contrabassoon at the bottom, just going, yeah, it's like, you're just there for a good time, and it's really great. And I believe this is what opens up the show.
Perhaps, yeah. I think so.
And I think that's like the... If it is, I think that's a really great choice. Don't quote me on that. Maybe I should...
Yeah, it's all good.
Okay. Either way, it's like the perfect thing to put on a French menu program, I guess. Because it just... It's something that everyone knows. It's got the quacky bassoon part. It's got great parts for everyone. It's just such descriptive music. Mm-hmm. I really love it. And it'll be fun to just play it again.
I like that you said quacky bassoon part, but don't get offended, anybody.
I said that, so that's okay.
You're not quacking. You're just quirky. Right?
Quirky, yes. Quacky. Exactly.
Yeah, indeed. But yeah, you're right that when you're all playing in unison, there's not a lot of room for... emotive digression, but it is something that you get to discuss exactly the articulation, for example,
right.
if a certain phrasing needs to end before it continues on. I don't know, stuff like that. It's fun to discuss with your wonderful colleagues. We have a couple of also brand new bassoonists in the section.
Yeah.
Maggie O'Leary has been here for, I guess, 2 seasons now.
And Maggie's just one of the best. I mean, yeah. I was at New World with her, too.
Right. Yes, we also overlapped there.
Yeah, so her and I have done just a ton of music together. Mm-hmm. And then we have another great bassoonist named Kevin Granger. He is also, he's an acting bassoonist in our section. He's utility bassoon. The official title is utility bassoon and contrabassoon. That's the instrument that's double the length of a normal bassoon and gets you that really sweet low note action.
Yeah, sounds like a foghorn if you play it right.
If you play it right, yeah. But they're just wonderful people, and I mean, every time we sit next to each other to play, it's just like, yeah, that's a no-brainer. That's how it's supposed to go. Duh.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Well, the bassoon and the cello are, I say, cousins or, yeah. or relatives. And in the orchestra, we very frequently play the same notes, of course, play the same lines. And it's nice when you guys are so solid that we can listen to you and play with you and not have to question the beat at all. You guys lay it down.
Right.
Nicely.
Well, thanks.
So, I looked at our concert, and we are starting the second half with The Sorcerer's Apprentice,
okay.
which is great. But the beginning of the concert is something else, a piece that I've never actually played or heard live, but I have known about it for a while. It is called The Pleasure Dome of Kubla Khan.
Mm.
It's by a composer named Charles Griffiths.
Yes.
And I am a big fan of Charles Griffiths. There are a couple of other pieces he wrote, which I've conducted and played, but this Pleasure Dome of Kubla Khan is a luxurious, ridiculous orchestration of a piece.
Yeah.
And a cool way to set up this otherwise French concert to give us all these different textures and colors and currents of music.
And then wasn't he an American?
I think so.
That's impressive to me that like an American can write that. And I think he actually, unfortunately, he had a really, his life stopped short, I think, if I remember reading that correct. But he went over to Paris and he studied with Nadia Boulanger and like all rubbing elbows with all these other great impressionistic composers. And he comes back to America and he's able to write something like this. I just think that's really impressive. And I just salute him like crazy because he's an American. And whenever we think American composer, we think Copeland, we think Bernstein, you know, these are classics, but even though there are so many more Americans than that, but this is that gateway into, wow, the impressionistic style can really be taught and taught really well.
That's right. And he would have been just a little earlier in history than the Copeland and Bernsteins.
Exactly.
So he's still so steeped in that post-romantic tradition and aiming for that sound world.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
What's the story of Kubla Khan?
I don't recall everything about him, but definitely his Pleasure Dome was a scandalously sensual kind of chamber.
Interesting. Well, yes. He describes it really well musically. It really is very voluptuous music.
Right. And, you know, it's brilliant programming. This concert is conducted by William Eddins, guest conductor, who's wonderful. And so the concert starting with this Griffiths piece, then the last piece on the concert is Daphnis et Chloé, Suite number 2 by Maurice Ravel. And that is also very sensual.
Yes.
Beautiful orchestration. One of the pieces that literally changed my life when I heard it for the first times in high school and in college. And every time I get to play it, it's just such a pleasure. And it starts with the rising of the sun. But there are some wild, I'm just going to call them parties. I'm not going to go into it. I do much on the radio, but you can hear some sounds in that that give you pause and imagery.
Ravel is so amazing because of his orchestration alone.
Mm-hmm.
And how he writes out that sunrise in the beginning is just so, he paces it so well. And then it starts from the bottom. And then what he'll do is he'll write like the lower sounding instruments, like bassoon and horn and trombone. He'll like write them in their highest register that they can go. And it's this perfect bridge that then the lowest of the next highest group can join in. And it's just really coherent line that you hear from the depths all the way up to the top. And that I agree with you. I think my first time hearing the complete ballet of Daphnis and Chloe from the Florida Orchestra.
Wow. Like, I have not heard the complete.
Oh, it's great.
Amazing.
If you want, the second suite is like great. I mean, it does a great job of explaining Daphnis and Chloe, but like the whole ballet and the story and all the little orchestration techniques he does for the whole entire ballet. So cool. Again, another piece with four bassoons in it. And, He'll write out the characters because Chloe gets kidnapped by some pirates and Daphnis ends up saving her. Like, just an incredible story. But I love the second suite. The second suite is amazing. The ending with the 5-4 dance.
Yes.
And it's just furious. But like, oh, it's great. Yeah. And the E-flat clarinet and stuff. Yeah, it's awesome. And that's ending the show, you said.
Right, okay. That is the end of the show.
What a finale to go out on with that.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, yeah. Since we've both mentioned the sunrise of this piece, I want to give people this beautiful, about a minute of music to listen to how Ravel builds and builds the orchestration, starting with low instruments, as you said, the bass and cellos, starting the melody as low as possible, the clarinets and the harps doing these murmuring waves of sound. And it's quite incredible. So please enjoy a little bit of Daphnis and Chloe's Sunrise.
How do you not get chills?
Such amazing music.
Listening to that.
I do. I have chills right now.
Me too. I mean, and do you think when he was writing that, he was like, they're going to love this? Like, he just knew it was going to be amazing like that? I mean, he must have.
I wonder. And, you know, if you look at the score itself and kind of break it down, the orchestration, the layers are fascinating. And that's the real genius of it. But the melody itself is very simple. It's essentially the same exact measure over and over again, just a little higher each time. Da 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 da, and then it's again a little higher, a little higher.
Yeah.
And he does it one more time than you think, another time more until it's just built up to this most glorious thing, and he brings in the high glistening percussion and everything.
Yeah, and it really shines and shimmers at the end, and if there ever was to be a suite from Daphnis and Chloe where you don't play the whole ballet, I mean, this is the one that you start with. It's just amazing.
Mm.
Wow.
Well, thanks for
I love Ravel.
Sharing in that love with me. Me too. Me too. I was talking to somebody recently at a party he's a guitarist and also a composer. Mm. And I asked him, so what are you into in classical music? And he said, Ravel's my favorite. I said, we are friends now.
Yeah, you're cool. Like, you're actually cool.
I appreciate you. Absolutely.
I don't think there's a piece by Ravel I dislike. And I know everyone loves to knock on Bolero.
That's the thing that came to mind. I'm sorry.
No, I love Bolero.
It's a wonderful piece of music.
A lot of people don't like it.
If you're ready to sit through all of the variations, because obviously it's repetitive, but it's different every time. Yeah. So it's not boring.
It's so,
by no means.
It is like the most, yeah, the longest paced crescendo orchestrationally.
Right.
I've always thought of it. And like, it's just, I love it. It's great. Mm-hmm. I love the bassoon solo in there. I'm biased, but
there are some theories about Ravel's mental state at the end of his life, that he had some kind of disease actually, where he would fixate on things and really loved patterns. And that is the time in his life that he wrote Bolero. So,
and well, in
makes sense.
It's interesting you say that, because his death was caused by a surgery that kind of went wrong to try to fix such a thing. Mm-hmm. His life had gotten cut short that way too, with going under the knife, I think.
Oh.
Or going into surgery, or at least it was from complications. But well, what music he left us, though.
Yeah, that Daphnis and Chloe is from 1909 to 1912, was when he was writing it. Long and time. It was involved in the Ballet Russe with Serge Diaghilev, mm-hmm, and Fokine. And apparently it was not going so well at the premiere.
Really?
At least Diaghilev almost wanted to cancel it because he wasn't,
what,
convinced by the music. Can you believe that? But
huh?
Ravel said, no, this is what I believe in. And even the premiere itself wasn't that great, because 10 days before the premiere of Daphnis et Chloé, they did Debussy's Prélude après midi d'un faune.
Oh, another great piece.
Prélude of the Afternoon of a Faun, which is, of course, also an iconic ballet and score. Usually we see it just on the orchestral stage, but with the original ballet with Nijinsky and stuff, it's also quite evocative.
It's shocking to me that Diaghilev was just like, no, I don't think the music's going to really work out. But he had spent like 3 years crafting this masterpiece.
Yes.
Wow. And Diaghilev is also the same person that Stravinsky worked with just a few years, or even 1 year after that, to produce the ballet production of Rite of Spring, the Rite of Spring, Le Sacre du Printemps.
Yeah.
And Diaghilev kind of said the same thing to Stravinsky of like, so when's the music part come in? and there's the famous quote of Stravinsky telling Diaghilev, till the end, my dear, till the end. And of course, we all know how the premiere of Rite of Spring went.
With a riot and all kinds of crazy stuff.
We need to bring that back.
What, that kind of audience reaction?
Yeah.
Okay, everybody. So you heard him. You heard Brendan Sill. Next time you come to the Florida Orchestra, we want you to applaud and rage so much that you storm the house.
Let the music move you.
Let it. Yes, that's right. That's right.
On full disclosure, I am kidding.
Yeah. Right. And there's a whole thing about making sure you only clap when the whole audience is clapping, right? In between movements, if it gets really quiet.
Yeah.
That's not necessarily the time to whoop and holler and clap, right? You just sort of go with the flow. I'm always a fan of applauding when you feel moved to do so.
Yeah.
If the first movement ends super loud and exciting, you better clap. Come on. That's what I think.
I've always seen that. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's like people are like, why can't they wait till the end to clap? And it's like, well, if you're doing like, okay, the end of the first movement of Mahler 1, where it's just like, you know, who's supposed to stay silent after that?
Absolutely.
And if, especially if the orchestra did a great job, I've always seen it as like the compliment. Now, like you said, also, if there's some pause and like and it ends really like sensitively, and you're supposed to just sit with the music,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
I like that silence. And that goes for after the piece is concluded too. Like if it's a like end of Mahler 9,
yeah,
it's leaving this earth. He's leaving this earth.
It is about passing on and. So
I want 30 seconds of silence.
Absolutely. Or what I want to hear is a collective sigh.
I want
to hear the audience go, wow, that was amazing.
Yeah.
And then just sit there with it, sit in the music. Like, I'm getting chills thinking about that too, because those are some of the most special moments of music making for us, is when we feel that the room is with us.
Yeah.
We're all on the same page.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, it was tradition back in the classical era, Mozart, Beethoven, all of these people, if you didn't get applause after a loud movement, then it wasn't a very good piece.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know
that. And there were quite a few occurrences when the audience would demand an encore of the movement they just heard before they could even move on. That's true of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony.
The second movement, right?
Second movement.
Wow.
With that beautiful melody that goes on and on. And after it ended, They said, we must hear that again.
Wow.
Before we could get onto the scherzo.
I also heard that there were other symphonies that were being composed after that, that a lot of times if the orchestra didn't see the slow movement of whatever symphony they were playing as like mature enough or as good enough, they would just replace it with the slow movement from Beethoven 7. So could you imagine doing like, I don't know, maybe like Mendelssohn. I mean, Mendelssohn's such a bad example because everything he wrote was perfect.
It was wonderful, yeah.
Perfect.
Right. But you're in the middle of a piece and they say, we don't like this one.
Let's do Beethoven 7. Second movement.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Although people would argue that that is not a slow movement. Right.
It depends. Your conductor is showing.
indeed. Right. It's Allegretto, after all.
Yeah. This is the truth.
By the way, I should remind those who might be listening on the radio to us that this is The Classical Scene. I'm Victor Hulls, and my guest today is Brendan Sill, principal bassoon of the Florida Orchestra. And we are talking about all of the amazing concerts that we have coming up, because after the holidays, it's go, go, go time.
It really is.
Every single week of the season, you know, from September to May, every week we have a different performance to offer. So in January, we started with the Masterworks. Then January 14th and 15th, that's one of our matinees based on music involving water. So it's called H2O, Symphony in H2O. So we've got Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture, right? And you can hear the waves. And also some fabulous music by Benjamin Britten. The 4C Interludes from Peter Grimes.
So good.
That is some of my favorite music.
Me too.
Of all. And, you know, we had a sunrise already on this show from Ravel. But I want to play you just a moment from Peter Grimes, which is the beginning of the second interlude, and that is Sunday Morning. And you can hear like the bells of the church reinterpreted in the horns, and then this happy little scurrying motive in the flutes and violins, kind of like the people getting ready and putting on their finest clothes and just being all cheery. So Here's just a little bit of that Britten. Music plummets down to a very different mood there, but isn't that just so cheerful?
So
I love
great.
That. That's actually a recording by Stefan Deneuve conducting the New World Symphony.
Oh.
Brendan.
Represent.
Were you involved in this recording?
I was. I'm on that recording.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that was the first concert of our season. That was my second year. At that point, you had started here in TFO.
Right. I had just left New World.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first concert of the season.
I remember you and Monsieur Deneuve talking about the full opera,
Peter
Grimes by Britten, and you were really going for it, trying to make that happen.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe you remembered that. Yeah, so
I do,
it was when Deneuve was first announced as our new director in that November, and then they had each section of the orchestra like just sit down and talk to him over lunch. And he sat up my table last, and we were just talking back and forth, rap and stuff like that, and he said, okay, I have an offer. Whatever piece you want to do, say it now and we'll do it next year. And I thought to myself, well, this is an opportunity too good to pass up. And I at that point in time, I had just an obsession of Peter Grimes, the opera, the entire opera, because this piece is from an opera. These are just the orchestral bits that kind of move from the scene to scene.
Right.
And I just love Britten, but I love Peter Grimes. And I just said, well, I have an idea. New World doesn't do opera, and I think maybe that's something we should dip our toes into, pardon the pun.
That's right. Yes, it's all about the ocean.
It's all about the ocean, the sea. And I said, I just love Peter Grimes, and I think we're in a perfect place on the beach to be able to do something like that, and we can think outside the box with that. And he said, oh, I love Peter Grimes. And
I wonder if we can do it.
And this was sort of our way of...
In between.
Yeah, a little in between.
But then he did program the War Requiem.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It was a big collaborative concert. So very, very good stuff happening there.
It was such a magical place for sure. And just so many out-of-the-box ideas, really creative ideas.
Yeah, and the New World Symphony is a training orchestra. So it's where people like us... and actually a lot of other alumni of New World Symphony are in the Florida Orchestra.
It's the
place where we all get ready for our professional careers.
I needed it. I know that for sure. It was the perfect place for me. It's America's Orchestral Academy. That's what we called it. I mean, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. It was incredible. That's how Victor and I met.
Yeah.
And so many other people.
Some great collaborations. Well, it's so fun to just hear your earnest and genuine love of music. You know, you're a perfect guy for the radio. You even said that you had some aspirations to do radio yourself,
I'd be lying if I said I didn't have any.
What was that about in Cleveland, right?
Yeah. So when I was at CIM, the Cleveland Institute of Music, there were, you know, some classes that and coursework you had to take to in order to fill out your academia there. And as a grad student there, I decided to dip my toe a little bit into recording for non-majors, broadcasting for non-majors. And there's an incredible radio station there called WCLV, IdeaStream, that you can go to the website of and listen to the radio. And it's an incredible classical music radio station. But they had us talk to some of the radio hosts. They had us read from scripts. They had us rigorous exercises to not go... No dead air.
Right. Train your speech.
Yeah. Which can be really hard, but it was really fun and really eye opening. And, I need to take that course again. I just said, but it was incredible. And I have just a huge amount of respect for any radio host, especially classical music radio hosts. The amount of knowledge you have in order to know what you're putting on, how you're explaining it, the dates of the composer, the birthday, the pieces context in society, so much than a lot of other radio hosts might need to know.
Indeed. I feel very fortunate that down here in St. Pete and through Tampa, we can listen to WSMR. I have that on in the car all the time, listening to the classical radio station.
Me too.
And Thea Lobo coming on and sharing her expertise with it, and just wonderful playlists. And frequently I'm discovering music I didn't know about at all, and that's a treat. And then sometimes I hear a recording of us in the Florida Orchestra too.
That's always really nice to hear too. And it's always really good to have like music on the air that isn't that popular. We all know Beethoven 5 and 7 and 9. We know Brahms 1. We know Stravinsky, Rite of Spring,
Firebird Suite,
of course,
et cetera.
And there's a reason that's well known, because it is great music. But I want to hear
The Pleasure Dome of Kubla Khan by Charles T. Griffiths, for example.
Which we will be playing.
Yeah.
And I want to hear a Ives and Messiaen and all these really out-of-the-box composers.
It's the job of the orchestra in the 21st century to blend things and give us our historical value and also, trudge forward into a new era and showcase living composers, more recent works, things that have been forgotten along the way in any time period,
right,
and give our audiences a nice mixture. And I think we do a great job of that because, again, we have so many concerts. Because after this water-based concert, then we go into a Billy Joel Pops concert.
Right.
Well, you'll have a dozen or more favorite hits of Billy Joel played by some amazing cover artists. That's January 16th and 17th. And then the very next weekend is when we do this wonderful concert of all the French music we've been talking about.
Yeah.
So again, that concert has a lot of bassoon features. We already nerded out about the Sorcerer's Apprentice, and we listened to some beautiful sunrise music of Daphnis et Chloé. But also on that concert is Ravel's Piano Concerto.
Mm.
And
Concerto in G, yeah.
Yeah, Concerto in G. And that's also a kind of famous bassoon piece.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. I think that's probably my favorite piano concerto. I mean, here's the thing. I have a huge soft spot for any Rachmaninoff piano concerto.
Of course.
Like the third concerto.
Second and third all day, every day.
And the first and the fourth, honestly, are also really great.
Yep.
But the Ravel Concerto in G is so iconic because he took a trip to the United States before writing it in the 20s, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, so there's quite a bit of jazz influence in it. Ravel and French composers and jazz, there's a whole lot of cross-pollination
to
our benefit.
He came to New York City, and he was treated like royalty because at that point in time, he was probably the most famous composer, living composer at that point in time. I mean, there were others. I mean, Strauss was also very heavily, highly regarded.
Right.
But Ravel, he was like, wow, what is this music I'm hearing over here in the United States? I'm going to implement that. And he did a really great job, if I say so myself. And so I love the themes in it. But yeah, the bassoon stuff, now every other piece on the show has four parts in it, four bassoon parts, which we should not overlook. But the Concerto in G is one of the most asked for excerpts on any bassoon audition. Because you have this incredible architecture that Ravel puts in for you in the first movement. So what needs to be said is that there's actually two different kinds of bassoons. There's the French bassoon, and then there's the German bassoon. And Ravel, of course, wrote for the French bassoon, and the French bassoon sounds very different from the German bassoon. It has a tighter bore, it has a smaller bore, like the pipe that goes through. And it sounds just a little less, projection-y. It's more. Let me rephrase that. The French bassoon is a little bit more constricted in its bore, so it sounds a little more nasally. But you're able to get really, really great high notes out of it. So any French excerpt you play on the bassoon is always going to be really, really high because that bassoon can play it that high. And that's always been a really big challenge for anyone who plays on the German bassoon, which about 90% of the world plays on a German bassoon, maybe 95%. So it's the responsibility of the player to find a really good read and obviously practice it over and over again, because in the first movement of the Concerto in G, after this beautiful, beautiful, lush section played by the piano that's introducing the second theme, this really just oozing with jazz.
Oh yeah.
Ravel decides to write, you know what, I'm pretty sure a bassoon could do that, so I'm going to write it in. And you have at the very top of this line a high E written for the bassoon, which is the highest note you can play on a bassoon. Technically, it's the highest note in any repertoire play.
That's the E that is high for an alto voice to sing. That's the open E string of a violin.
Yes.
That's a very high note.
Yeah, it's very high. Mm-hmm. And it's awesome because you get to, you just play it over the whole orchestra while the whole orchestra is going.
And you want to soar and not plummet.
You want to soar and not plummet. Yeah, you can't fly too close to the sun.
Okay.
Like Icarus. But it is such a cool effect. And the piano is just in the right hand going. It's so cool. And I love. This is so nerdy to admit, but I'll find just a bunch of recordings and just compare the E's. I'll be like, oh, okay, that E was a little sharper. That was a little flat.
That E started well, but faltered in the middle.
And there are many recordings that do that.
Yeah.
But it's just so cool because Ravel could have easily written that for oboe or English horn, because there is an English horn part, a very large English horn part in the second movement. That's gorgeous. But he doesn't do that. He writes it for bassoon.
Yeah.
And it actually kind of reinvented the bassoon after that too, because at that point in time, not every bassoon had a high E key. They only went up to maybe high D, maybe high C.
Okay.
High D if you were lucky. But after that, people started realizing we need extra keys for this thing so that we can play this concerto. And it's really cool to see Ravel, just like Stravinsky, kind of reinvent the bassoon after such pieces made their way in such big ways. So yeah, I love the excerpt.
That's super cool. So what is this spot where we're going to listen to?
This is the exact part. This is coming out of that lush piano part in the first movement of the Concerto in G by Ravel. And this is a great recording that I've always come back to. This is the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Eugene Ormandy, and the piano is played by Philippe Entremont. And the principal bassoon of this recording, I believe it's from 1972. It's Bernard Garfield, who to me is one of the best, if not the best American bassoonist who will ever live. Mm. He was principal bassoon of the Philadelphia Orchestra from 1957 until 2000. He actually just passed away in 2025 at the age of 100.
Oh my God, what a life, what a career.
And he sounds incredible on this recording, and I've always just come back to this. I actually have this on vinyl.
Oh, nice.
record player, and it sounds perfect. And I actually wanted to bring this out onto the air because I just think it just makes me like grin ear to ear every time I hear it.
Fun music. Yeah, and that is an impressive little moment for the bassoon to be lofty in the air.
And it introduces this big band element to it. And you wouldn't think bassoon would do that. But yeah, I mean, Victor can attest here. As we were just listening to that here on the air, I was just like smiling so big on the other side of the table.
Yes, absolutely.
it's just great.
And then when the rest of the orchestra comes in with... like,
yeah, it's so... descriptive and so imaginative.
Yeah, this recording we're using also has the pianist Philippe Entremont. Wonderful. But when we perform it in the Florida Orchestra on January 23rd, 24th, and 25th, we will be joined by guest artist George Lee on the piano. And George Lee and I go way back, actually, to high school.
Wow.
At Walnut Hill School of the Arts. I went there for my last year of high school. And he was younger than I was, but he was already being the amazing prodigy soloist with our orchestra on tour and whatnot.
That's amazing.
So every time I run into him again, New World, here, wherever, it's always a great time. So I'm excited to welcome him back to this side of town, and he will definitely dazzle everyone, and I really hope he'll give us an encore or something.
Oh, that would be great, huh? Like what, something from Miroir? From
Ooh.
Ravel?
Okay, I'll put in a special request.
Yeah, please do. I would love to hear that on stage. That'd be cool. Or maybe the first movement of Le Tombeau de Couperin, the piano arrangement.
Absolutely.
That could be good.
You mean the real one?
True. Well, I forgot. That's okay. Not the arrangement. That's the original.
Le Tombeau de Couperin has had multiple versions, of course.
Yeah, right.
Originally for piano and has a wonderful oboe solo and whatnot in the chamber
famous.
Orchestra version.
Yeah, right.
Beautiful music. Anyway... if you can't tell, we are diehard Ravel fans and can't wait to share this music with you. And just to recap, what we started the program with was a little bit of Beethoven's Triple Concerto. And that concert coming up on February 6th and 7th, there's also an Inside the Music on February 5th, which is a good way to get to know the music.
Yeah, it is.
That will be played by our musicians. And then on the second half, we do Bruckner's Fourth Symphony. And I have not yet played a Bruckner Symphony with Michael Francis, but I'm sure that will be quite an epic evening.
Have you ever done a Bruckner Symphony before, ever?
I have played 4 and 5 and 6.
Wow, okay, actually. You've done a lot more than me. I've only done 8.
Recently.
Oh, only recently.
Yeah.
Is that while you were here in TFO?
This was mainly in a summer festival up in Wisconsin. It's called the Peninsula Music Festival. And our new music director there, Rune Bergman, likes... Bruckner, definitely. He even made shirts that say Bruckner baby on them.
Oh my gosh.
And by the way, Rune Bergman is coming to conduct the Florida Orchestra later. I think it's in April, and he's doing a concert with Sibelius Second Symphony, some Rautavaara, some really wonderful stuff.
Oh yeah, so. That's going to be a great show too. Sibelius too. Talk about really great bassoon parts in that.
Oh
well.
My God, it's wonderful.
Really great stuff.
Yeah, well, I love it. Well, Brandon, I have enjoyed this so much. It's so easy to talk with you.
Oh, likewise.
As everyone can tell, I'm sure. So, yeah, thanks for listening to this episode, number 13 of The Classical Scene.
Number 13.
I can't believe I've already made this many of them, but it's just so much fun. And I think in the next one, we'll be talking about some opera opportunities that are going on nearby. So stay tuned and go out there and support your local classical music. Come see us at the Florida Orchestra and have a wonderful, happy new year, everybody.
Hope to see you soon, everyone.
Absolutely. And to take us out, we'll just listen to the very end of the Ravel Piano Concerto because it's so happy.
Yeah.
And kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So cheers. Thanks again to Brendan Sill, acting principal bassoon of Florida Orchestra, for being here.
You're very welcome.